Okay, let's move forward through the programme to Andrew Gray, who's I think, are you going to speak from there or here? Yeah, come here. He's going to talk to us about the carbon pollution reduction scheme and the risks and opportunities embodied in it. Andrew joined Goldman Sachs J.B. Weir in 1991. He's appointed as J.B. Weir's first quantitative analyst. Isn't that right? Absolutely the first quantitative analyst in January 1994, so that's quite a record, before being appointed as head of quantitative research in 1999. As part of this role, Andrew has provided research to the investment community on quantitative stock selection, portfolio construction and management of investment risk. The team in which Andrew heads has developed portfolio construction and risk management tools which are now widely used amongst professional investors. And more recently, Andrew's moved to include consideration of environmental, social and governance factors in investing, with an emphasis on the role they play as part of the mainstream investment process. So moving what was a narrow sector into the broad sector. So please join me in welcoming Andrew to the stand.
Thank you, Fred. Yes, it's an interesting combination, a quant analyst becoming a new age ESG person. But it's quite interesting because I guess one of the focuses that we're trying to sort of bring to ESG research is really focusing on the tangible links between some of these issues and you know, valuation and company returns. And that's where I think the carbon pollution reduction scheme is quite interesting, because it does sort of translate the issue into sort of a tangible valuation outcome potentially, which is why we're obviously focused on it. Now, I'm probably going to commit, I think, what's become a mortal sin throughout this presentation. Out of habit, I'm probably going to refer to it as the ETS, or the Emissions Trading Scheme, as opposed to the Carbon Pollution Reduction Scheme. So if I refer to it as that, that's obviously what I'm talking about. Well, as a quant analyst, I must say life in this space is very frustrating. Obviously, what I would like to do to get out of the ETS is get the number, plug it into a spreadsheet and have some definitive answers on valuation outcomes. In particular, from an investment context, the following really are the key questions. Firstly, how will it impact on the earnings and therefore valuation of a listed equity portfolio? For the listed equity market as it currently stands in Australia, this is likely to be a cost in the majority of cases due to the potential for direct carbon liabilities and also increases in energy costs. Some companies, however, may have the potential to generate carbon trading revenues or commercialise low emissions technologies. But with alternative energy companies in the Australian listed market currently very small, this may not be a significant opportunity initially, but obviously we could expect that to grow over time. The second key question for investors is, outside the listed equity space, what opportunities will be available? For example, direct investments through private equity, or specialist funds in new technologies. What needs to happen here, though, with the investment community is a move to a greater focus on the opportunities and the new technologies the ETS is designed to encourage than has been the case, really, in the sort of debate so far. But as I mentioned, the life of a quant analyst is very frustrating, because the reality at this stage is we really don't yet have the sufficient details to run the numbers and get definitive answers to the key valuation impact questions. But having said that, we have come quite a long way since the change of government, you know, with the Kyoto Protocol being signed, and suddenly a cap-and-trade style ETS is a reality in the near future. In fact, if anything, there are some people questioning how we got to facing this type of ETS so quickly without any real discussion of alternatives such as a carbon tax or different methods to determine permit allocation. When we interview listed companies as part of our ESG research, one of the questions we typically ask them is, how likely do you think it is that the government is likely to stick with the somewhat tight 2010 timeframe for scheme introduction? And interestingly, nearly every company describes that the government has significant resolve to stick to its timetable, despite pressure from some of these companies themselves to actually lengthen what they see as a very ambitious timetable. So our view, based on such feedback, is that the 2010 start date is very firm, and therefore the ETS is a definite issue for investors from then, and in fact really almost immediately, as details of the scheme are progressively released, and obviously December with the white paper coming out is a key time frame there. But I guess the question is, how material will the ETS be at start-up, and how soon it becomes material after start-up date, you know, are really the key questions. And we'll talk about that in some of the slides in a moment. But as indicated, we'd summarise the status of the ETS from an investment perspective as follows. The government's green paper has provided us with the key design points around the scheme. Last week, the Garno Review released its final report recommending emissions trajectories and carbon prices, and revealing, I guess, what most would describe as a somewhat conservative emissions trajectory. And as I mentioned before, the government's white paper due in December is really the next key milestone where we should get a lot of the detail that investors need to model the outcomes of the ETS. So before we sort of move on to some of the numbers, I'll just sort of quickly go over the sort of key design features of the ETS as we see it in terms of trying to put investment research around it. So obviously the underlying purpose of the ETS is to put a price on carbon, to make carbon no longer economically invisible, and hence drive down the economic attractiveness of carbon-intensive technologies relative to non-carbon-intensive technologies. The ultimate aim, obviously, is to drive investment into non-carbon-intensive technologies. As I think has been mentioned several times today, it's obviously going to be cap-and-trade systems where emissions caps are set for each company. Under this system, permits would be sold to each company equal to the emissions caps, and companies can then trade any surpluses or deficits that arise as a result of their actual emissions being less than their or different to their caps. Over time, the emissions caps will be tightened, and this is known as the emissions trajectory, and this is actually what will drive the reduction in emissions over time. And it's really the constantly tightening trajectory that it will effectively create over time a scarcity of supply in the permits, and thereby setting up the supply-demand tension in the scheme. So according to the carbon price established in the scheme is actually very sensitive to the emissions trajectory, and this was actually revealed quite dramatically in the European scheme. And those implementing the scheme, therefore, are likely to use this trajectory as a way to engineer a carbon price in a broad sense. For example, in the early years of the scheme, we may expect a relatively conservative reduction in the trajectory, hence permit supply will not be particularly tight, we don't think, and thereby resulting in a relatively soft start to the scheme and a soft carbon price in the initial years. But we can expect this to tighten over time so as to potentially achieve a carbon price of perhaps $30 or $40 a tonne once we get out to 2020. So effectively, the ETS is a market-based carbon price-setting mechanism, but I think important to realise only within the overall supply and demand parameters that are actually set by those administering the system. So therefore, those running the system will have significant control over the price, and obviously, you know, one of their roles is to balance the need for a high enough price such that technology switching becomes viable versus not setting the price so high that it actually has a damaging economic impact. So I guess the discussion about cost to companies, you know, raises the question, well, how material is this thing actually likely to be? And as I mentioned earlier, we don't yet have a definitive answer, but this chart, and this is the chart that Tony referred to before, and it's based on the Carbon Disclosure Project that we released the day before yesterday. And we think it actually represents quite a good starting point. So, you know, we refer to it as our base case carbon liability modelling, but strongly make the point that given the carbon price and compensation levels are unknown, this is not how the final outcomes will turn out. But what the chart does is take the carbon emissions footprint of each company as reported to the CDP and multiplies this by an assumed $20 per tonne for the price of carbon. This gives us the potential carbon liability for each stock. And then what we do is then divide that into the profit of each stock. We're actually using a pre-tax, pre-depreciation and amortisation number. And so what it's actually showing you, therefore, is the percentage of each stock's profit that this carbon liability is likely to represent. So what we can see on the chart is that there are actually a number of companies, well, actually 11 companies out of the survey, where the carbon liability in a base case level may be 5% of their earnings or more. And therefore potentially quite material. And as little known fact that quant analysts actually have much better eyes than the average population, so I can see the codes on that chart, but I know you can't. But those companies Alumina, BlueScope and OneSteel, they're the first three, and as Tony mentioned, there's actually more than 20% of their earnings potentially in carbon liabilities. And then moving down the rest of the 11, Contact Energy, Qantas, Boral, Orica, Rio, Paperlinx, Santos and Woodside. But as Tony mentioned, and I'd reiterate, the actual details of the scheme will mean that the financial outcome won't actually look like this, but we think it's a useful starting point. And that's why I'll move on in the next few slides to sort of look at some of the issues that need to be considered around this. Okay, so moving from this sort of theoretical base case to actual outcomes, this is the sort of framework for analysis that we're using. So basically the equation to look at the sort of final outcome is starting off with the underlying carbon risk as per the previous chart, less any compensation the company is likely to achieve under the ETS, and then less the potential the company has to pass through the carbon cost down its supply chain and onto its customers. And this will actually, we think, be a really important dynamic once the scheme gets up and running. In fact, it's interesting to note that our utility analyst expects that the electricity generators will have the ability to fully pass through any carbon costs they incur. So setting up the proposition that the ETS will certainly have the ability to increase electricity prices across the economy. So it's worth examining, I think, the compensation part in more detail, as we think really this is the key issue in terms of how the scheme might impact on investment outcomes. So essentially, from the policymaker's perspective, compensation is seen to be required to prevent carbon leakage, which is the result where companies simply move offshore to avoid carbon cost. And the result of that, obviously, is that there would be no improvement in the global carbon outcome. So it's actually quite a vexed question, which the Garnaut Review described as truly dreadful. Because if too much compensation is given, the price signal that acts as the incentive to alter behaviour is watered down and ends up not achieving the desired aim of carbon abatement. It's essentially a problem resulting from moving ahead of our trading partners in the pricing of carbon. If you wanted to put a more moralistic spin on it, you could say it's actually a problem as a result of our trading partners not moving fast enough on the issue. I think it's come up a couple of times today. The world seems to be able to find a global coordinated response to saving the banking system. Perhaps the same resolve needs to occur for the climate change issue. So the Green Paper, therefore, was pretty clear in that it was proposing to compensate trade-exposed industries for some of the carbon costs they incur on the basis that not to do so means that they may become uncompetitive versus their global peers. Now, as part of the lobbying process that companies are currently now undertaking to the government, it's amazing how many are actually arguing how trade-exposed they really are. It's interesting to note that out of the list that identified in our chart earlier as having high carbon exposure, it's plausible that nearly every one of them could actually qualify as being trade-exposed and therefore qualify for compensation. And I guess that's the difference between that chart and the other chart that Tony showed, which would bring the cost potentially right down. But I think an important issue for investors is to consider that the Green Paper is proposing differing compensation levels for differing levels of emissions intensity. So it's proposing that low-intensity companies could get zero compensation, medium-intensity 60%, and high-intensity companies could be 90% compensated. So we understand actually that this scaled compensation proposal is one of the more controversial aspects of the scheme due to a couple of issues. Firstly, questions over the appropriateness of the measure used for emissions intensity, which is currently proposed by the Green Paper to be tonnes of CO2 per $1 million of revenue. There's been a lot of discussion whether this should be a more value-added based method instead. And also the arbitrariness of the intensity categories and the differential effect on companies that are at the margin of each category and just miss out on being a 90% company and go down to being a 60% company. And in terms of that lobbying process, again, it's actually interesting that the number of companies that we talk to who are now arguing how emissions intensive they are, trying to get up to that 90% compensation level. Our view at this stage is that this part of the scheme is still very fluid, given the levels of controversy around it, and so it's going to be obviously resolved in the next couple of months in the lead-up to the white paper. But our recommendation is that, you know, investors really need to monitor the developments of this aspect of the scheme very closely, and be aware that there could be wide differences in company impacts, you know, if a sort of a three-tiered compensation system actually ends up being brought in. One final point on compensation, it's worth noting that, you know, outside of trade-exposed industries, the Green Paper proposed direct assistance for electricity generators, so effectively full compensation for them. Just wanted to make a few comments on the carbon price and how we might look at modelling that. The latest signpost we have on the carbon price is the Garnaut report last week, with some sort of final recommendations for 2020 emissions targets and carbon prices. Essentially, his recommendation is for a fixed price at start-up of the scheme during a transition period which would run from the 2010 start-up date through to the conclusion of the Kyoto period in 2012. And the proposal was for a starting price of $20 a tonne potentially, you know, rising each year by 4%. Also, Garnaut's analysis indicated that to get to the level of abatement he is recommending, looking out to 2020, you know, this would potentially imply a carbon price of $34.50. So to the extent that there was sort of a consensus view on what people were expecting before that, I guess $20 was pretty well in line with what people may have been thinking would be a reasonable start-up price. So too potentially is the $34.50, although I'm not too sure about the 50 cents. But to the extent that the consensus view is that you likely need a price up to around $40 a tonne to encourage the technology switching that the scheme is encouraged is designed to encourage. So as we sort of talked about earlier, the way the scheme operates, it's the emissions cap that will drive the underlying supply and demand tension and therefore the carbon price over time. To that extent, Garnaut's recommended target of 550 parts per million concentration of carbon in the atmosphere is, you know, quite interesting to be aware of. That was a 550 parts per million target at 2050. It does appear somewhat conservative, given we are currently at 455 parts per million in the atmosphere at the moment, and the consensus among scientists is that it needs to be 450 parts per million in 2050 to have a significant chance of mitigating the effects of climate change. So the Garnaut report does recognise this issue by suggesting a 550 parts per million 2050 target is one that would have a reasonable chance of practical international agreement, and therefore should potentially be the starting point. But he also says a 450 parts per million target would definitely be a desirable sort of, you know, best case or better case aim. The Garnaut report also proposes that the tightness of emissions trajectories should be influenced by whether a comprehensive post-Kyoto global agreement of emissions targets can be achieved. So what he's basically saying is in the absence of a global agreement, he would recommend a 5% reduction in emissions by 2020 and 60% by 2050. If a comprehensive agreement can be reached globally, then he'd recommend a 10% reduction by 2020 and 80% by 2050, you know, which would get us to that 550 parts per million concentration target. So clearly we're sort of back to the message that, you know, at the end of the day, the tightness of the emissions trajectories, you know, the level of aggression in the scheme should really, you know, largely be determined by the extent to which other countries are also willing to act. From the point of view of investors assessing the ETS, you know, we'd consider Garnaut's targets as likely to be, you know, practical and achievable for business, you know, albeit somewhat conservative, I guess. And again, the white paper is really crucial in terms of getting the sort of final outcomes on this issue. So just before I sort of finish up, this just lists a couple of sort of other key issues which I don't really have time to sort of talk through in detail today. But of the ones listed on that slide, I guess the ones that I'd sort of focus on would be the usage of permit revenue. There's actually not been a lot discussed at this stage about how that's potentially being used. I mean, the Garnaut report has recommended 50% potentially going to households and 20% for research and development into the commercialisation of new technologies. But other than that, there, you know, really has been little discussion about that. I mean, obviously, what is left to be used depends a lot on the compensation issue, but that's certainly something that we need more information on going forward. Linkages to international schemes is also an important point. The policymakers are proposing quite clearly that that should occur. You know, and we'd say that from a long-term scheme operation perspective, that's certainly a positive, because the deeper, you know, more liquid scheme, the better. You know, obviously one of the issues there is the extent that you link it internationally, you know, means that our carbon price will then become inextricably linked to a global carbon price. And therefore, from a domestic economic policy perspective, you know, the policymakers would have less control over that. So there's an interesting sort of trade-off there. And the other one that I'd sort of highlight there is the role of carbon capture and storage. And, you know, one of the sort of views probably is that, you know, this is a technology which actually is potentially vitally important to Australia, given our abundant natural coal resource. And, you know, policymakers have shown that they are supporting this as a technology, so they've proposed to set up a $500 million fund to research it. And the other interesting comment from the Carbon Disclosure Project report release on Tuesday, we actually had Penny Wong, Minister for Climate Change, release the report. And she actually made the statement that without a solution to clean coal, there is not a solution to climate change. So I think that sort of states pretty clearly that, you know, the policymakers are seeing this as a key technology. You know, obviously one of the key issues is that it's very much a non-proven technology at this stage. But I'd argue, you know, from an investor context, if you're looking for a long-term investment theme, you know, it seems to me that policymakers are certainly favouring carbon capture and storage as something which they see, you know, needing to happen in an Australian context. So just a few comments to finish up on. So as I sort of mentioned earlier, you know, we're very confident the government is resolved to introduce the ETS in line with its 2010 stated timeframe. And, you know, we very much see it, therefore, as a current issue for investors, particularly from December, when the white paper should give us a lot of the necessary detail. Irrespective of the company-level detail, however, you know, it's important to note that the ETS, you know, the existence of it, you know, inherently sets up an investment theme that is negative for fossil fuel-intensive industries and positive for industries exposed to carbon abatement opportunities. And an observation that I'd make is that so far the general debate in Australia has focused on the cost to companies from an ETS rather than the investment opportunities that may be created. And I guess to an extent this has probably been driven by the structure of the Australian market, with minimal opportunities of either sufficient scale or proven technologies to attract the interest of investors. But, you know, investors should be aware that the essence of the ETS is to encourage technology switching, and obviously this should therefore change that landscape going forward. Certainly the feedback we have from the Department of Climate Change is that they would like the investment community to become more engaged on the opportunity side. As discussed earlier, carbon capture and storage appears to be likely to be an important technology, and there are several others, you know, such as geothermal, I think, is another you know, high-profile one in an Australian context. The reality is that at this stage none of these are well understood, but I guess we could expect greater focus on these sort of technologies by investors in a post-ETS world. In the meantime, for listed equity investments, our chart has shown the underlying carbon risk for companies, but the impact of the ETS is heavily dependent on that key issue of compensation. And, you know, that's something that investors really need to focus on, you know, once that detail comes out. So, as I say, we watch for developments closely and look for the white paper in December to finalise the key issues. And I think we're certainly heading into a very interesting couple of months. Just before I finish and potentially throw it open to questions, just wanted to quickly mention the Carbon Disclosure Report. So it's a report that looks like that. And if people want to get hold of it, I'm certainly happy to provide a copy to anybody. The interesting thing about the CDP is that it's a project which has been run globally for 6 years, and 3 years ago was expanded to cover the ASX 100. But what it effectively is, it's got a whole lot of investor signatories behind it. So it's really investors writing a survey to companies, asking for companies to tell them about the company strategy for dealing with climate change and also to get emissions information. So A, it's a very important source of information for investors, and B, I think the essence of it is very interesting, where it's actually investors proactively asking companies and saying they think these issues are important. So that's kind of evolved as, you know, one of the sort of key mechanisms that investors are using. And it's a great report if you're wanting some sort of detail on emissions data and what the sort of strategic opportunities and risks companies are seeing in climate change. Interestingly, the response rate for the CDP this year was very high. It was 72% for the ASX 100. And for the top 50, it was, I think it was about 84%. So it's actually now very well supported by companies. So it's a very good survey. One of the things that comes out of the CDP is what's called the Climate Leaders Index. And what we actually do, we score companies according to their CDP responses, and the top-rated companies actually go into the Climate Leaders Index. So again, I'd recommend, and the report discloses who those companies are, and I'd recommend that list of companies to investors who are trying to identify companies that are or do appear to be managing climate change well, and certainly willing to talk to investors about how they're managing it, and in that sense may sort of present lower risk investments going forward.
Well, thank you, Andrew, and thanks for managing the time. We do have some good time now for questions, and I look for the first. So, Richard comes in.
Andrew, I think you were quite right when you said it was possible there would be full compensation for the generators. I think the Green Paper talked about assistance intended to improve the investment environment, so that could be far less than full compensation. If I could just remark that many of the submissions to the Department of Climate Change on the Green Paper absolutely detested that proposal. And, for example, Engineers Australia called it confused and unwarranted.
Which proposal was that, the compensation?
The proposal, you mentioned that electricity generators might be compensated in full, but I don't think that's accurate.
No, okay. I agree. I think that there has been a lot of controversy about that proposal. So if you say that there was a lot of feedback to testing that proposal, certainly consistent with what I've heard as well.
Andrew, just a rider on that one. Isn't it also the case that the assistance to the emissions-intensive trade-exposed industries are actually going to be phased out over a specific period? It might run for 15 or 20 years.
That's right. I mean, they are talking about it's a sort of a temporary measure to sort of ease the scheme in.
Yeah, and over on the right here.
Was that me?
Yes.
Thanks for your presentation, Andrew. I'm just wondering, you mentioned CDP a few times. Have you done some analysis on the alignment between the way companies can set their boundaries in the CDP project and what it's likely to be like for the emissions trading scheme? So for like someone like Rio Tinto, for example, has a lot of offshoot companies, Coal and Allied, something majority owned by Rio Tinto that potentially could be in or out in a scheme, but they would probably disclose in CDP. Have you looked at those sort of...
A little bit. It's one of the questions in the CDP is, you know, does your company have a strategy for dealing with the emissions trading scheme? And it's quite interesting that, the level of... I think it's only 5% of respondents were actually able to talk about a detailed strategy that they do have around the ETS. So that kind of information flow specifically on the ETS issues is actually very thin on the ground at the moment. But they're exactly the sort of issues that, you know, we'll be looking at to say, well, some companies will have inherently by their nature greater flexibility to deal with the system relative to other companies. But I think the one message we get out of the CDP is that the response rate is very high, and companies are seeing that it is important for the way they're perceived to talk about climate change. But moving to the next step, do they actually have capital allocation decisions specifically based around climate change issues? Do they have specific strategies for the ETS? You know, that's still very new, and it's, you know, very thin on the ground in terms of that level of detail. There's still a lot of development that companies need to go through to get there.
Yeah, I can't see any further hands up, but I'll just ask one question around... you quoted Penny Wong and talking about clean coal. You know, without clean coal, there's no solution, which seems a bit strong. I mean, do the geothermal solutions and the solar thermal solutions seem, from your point of view, to be real players in this? Or biofuels, for instance?
In an Australian context, geothermal particularly seems to be a very promising technology. But I think if you look at, say, China, for instance, where they're still investing very heavily in coal-fired generation capacity, when you look at it on a global basis, I guess what the Minister was suggesting is that the world is so heavily invested in coal that, you know, clean coal really does need to be a key part of it. But, you know, within that, we'd certainly say individual countries might have their own solutions. So in Australia, geothermal, we would say, is a very good example. You know, in Europe, the nuclear question came up earlier. You know, in Europe, you know, nuclear energy is a lot more accepted, so that's, you know, obviously a potential solution for them.
Okay, thanks, Andrew. Any last questions? Any Oh, yeah. Over here. Centre.
Jill Green. Just wondering if I could ask a technical question about companies like Qantas with large international operations. How do all the emissions trading scheme in Australia will naturally affect the domestic operations, but do you have any understanding from the information in the Carbon Disclosure Project about how they'll be affected?
You know, not
how
really.
How they incorporate the international operations?
So again, that level of detail is still very thin. And obviously they're sort of one of the higher potentially affected companies on our chart, but that's where getting that sort of level of detail is really important to work out how that might come down once the scheme's actually in.
Can I just as potentially partially answer that? I believe the current situation is that aviation fuel is exempt from the Kyoto process, effectively. But it is, I've just come back from Europe, and they are working now to bring aviation into the European scheme for all operators operating in and out of Europe. So, for instance, Qantas might become impacted by that when and if that comes about.
And the other point I'd make there is one of the things the Green Paper talks about is point of obligation. So, for example, and transport fuels is covered by this, where you have an industry, you know, where you might have a whole, you know, obviously transport, there's a lot of small players creating their carbon emissions. What they're suggesting is it may be more efficient to impose the point of obligation or the carbon cost higher upstream. So the proposal is actually, in that case, to impose a cost on the transport fuel. So rather than the players paying for their emissions directly as they're emitted, they'd actually pay for it via higher transport fuels. So I guess from that, we'd certainly expect that Qantas would be facing, you know, higher transport fuels as a means of paying for its carbon.
Well, if anybody's got any burning questions, I may be able to catch up with Andrew during the break. And I'd like to thank Andrew for his specific insight into how the analytical community is going to look at all these issues. And please join with me in thanking him for that very interesting talk.